it hit me a few years ago that almost all the interventions that we've ever done that have worked to make people happier work by making them feel more connected.
Hello and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Sonia Lubomirsky on the show. Sonia is a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Originally from Russia, she received her AB summa cum laude from Harvard University and her PhD in social personality psychology from Stanford University. Her research has been featured in hundreds of magazines, newspapers, shows, and documentaries in North America, South America, Asia, Australia, and Europe. Dr. Lubomirsky's best-selling books, The How of Happiness and The Myths of Happiness, have been published and translated in over 16 countries. In this episode, I talked to Sonia about happiness. Across all of her research, Dr. Lubomirsky has found that connection is what makes people happy. So then, how do we form high-quality connections? Dr. Lubomirsky gives us insight on how to use kindness, reciprocity, and gratitude to maintain and strengthen our relationships. We also touch on the topics of psychedelics, interpersonal chemistry, and social media. It's always fun chatting with Sonia. She's a friend, and I really admire her research in the field. She's a real pioneer in the science of happiness. So I'm excited to share her ideas with this audience today. So without further ado, I bring you Sonia Lubomirsky.
How are you doing today?
I am doing amazing. How are you?
I'm doing amazing. Today was the first day of school, so it's a big day.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be on my humble podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Well, so as you know, I'm such a big fan of yours, and preparing for today's episode and reviewing your work, it's like, wow, like there's so many fascinating things to discuss. And you've been studying the topic of happiness for 30 years, more than 30 years.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, in grad school.
And 23 of those years, you've been studying how to increase it. Why did you get interested in this topic to begin with?
You know, it was serendipitous, actually. On the very first day of graduate school, I met with my advisor, whose name is Lee Ross, and he is one of the world's experts on conflict and negotiation, which is like the opposite of happiness. And we walked around I don't know who said it, probably he first said it. He said, what is the secret to happiness? And why are some people happier than others? And back then, this was in 1989. So yeah. You did your math. So more than 30 years ago, you know, there's only one person who really was studying happiness. That was Ed Diener, kind of the founder of the field of happiness. And there were just a few other kind of writers thinking about it. Obviously, for thousands of years, you know, thinkers and writers and poets have been talking about happiness. But empirical research was very minimum. So it's kind of serendipitous.
Yeah, I'm trying to like get my head back to that time period and what was being published in psychology at the time. So there was stuff on subjective well-being, life satisfaction. Martin Seligman, had he initiated positive psychology? No.
No, that was 10 years. That was 10 years later.
Because that was 1998. So there probably wasn't even much talk about things like such as purpose within the umbrella of happiness, right? There really was a focus on...
Now, of course, there's the humanistic tradition, you know, Maslow, of course, that already had been talking about these sort of positive constructs, more, you know, in terms of theory than, you know, like experimental research. So I think we, you know, myself and many others started kind of a very like rigorous empirical tradition studying these positive constructs experimentally.
And you wrote The How of Happiness?
That's right.
Which has amazing collection of activities and things we can do. Mm-hmm. When this discussion of happiness comes up, a lot of people ask me just how much we can change and how much is in our genes. I wanted to start off with just a higher level overview of that, because you've thought of that in a really, really nuanced way. And I believe you wrote a paper with Ken and Sheldon on this topic. If you could just give a high level overview of, you know, just how much is within our control, that would be wonderful.
Sure. Well, you know, originally we came up, Ken and I came up with a theory that we called the pie chart. And the idea there is that there's sort of three main determinants of happiness, kind of like three buckets of influences on happiness. One is our genetics, you know, our personality, which is, you know, very much influenced by genetics. The second one is our life circumstances, right? Some, if you're poor, if you live in a war zone, you know, if you're in an abusive relationship, right, you're going to be really unhappy. And then the third bucket is like what we actually can do in our daily lives to kind of maintain happiness. either make us happier or less happy for that matter, in terms of a kind of our daily behaviors and think in the ways that we think about things. And a long time ago, we tried to put numbers on those three categories. And we think that was a mistake because, you know, we really don't know what the numbers are. So now I guess our more nuanced perspective is that we still believe that there are these three types of influences on happiness. Genetics really are pretty powerful. Research with twins, research that compares twins that are identical to twins that are fraternal, shows that there's a really high like heritability component for happiness, like there is for almost any human trait, including love of jazz music, right? Including your blood pressure. And so identical twins are much more similar in their happiness levels than our fraternal twins. So we know that suggests that there's sort of a genetic component to happiness. So that is true, you know, but that doesn't mean that you're fated, right, to be a certain level. Our circumstances absolutely matter. But if we're kind of, you know, maybe a lot of the listeners of your podcast are like fairly comfortable, like they're not living in a war zone. And so their circumstances don't affect their happiness sort of as much as probably they think they will. But they do matter, of course. And then like what I've been studying, what a lot of researchers have been studying is like, what can we actually do to change our happiness? Like, you know, can we actually change our habits? Can we actually think in ways that are different? And so that's like the third component. So really, all of those three components matter. All of those three buckets matter. I just don't like to put numbers on them anymore. So, you know, we can't say like this percent of your happiness is due to like this factor.
Yeah, because, you know, heritability is all about, there's so many misunderstandings of what it means. It's just, it's a population statistic. You can't parse out what percentage within a person is genetic and which parts environment. It's all connected within a person. You were only talking about partitioning sources of variance, technically, with the heritability coefficient.
Yeah, no, and this is consistently misinterpreted. That's why, like, we want to be careful.
Right.
But, like, for example, we know that nations differ hugely in how happy, like, the average citizen is. And that really is consistent with research on genetics, because if you take the entire environment and you make it more fertile, you know, you make it, you know, more positive, then, like, everyone's going to be, you know, happier, well, to some extent. So good point, Scott.
Yeah, when the environment is equalized, genetics becomes more important in explaining the variance in an outcome. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that either, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, in a way, the extent to which genetics matters is the extent to which you have a just and fair society. So.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and Paige Harden, has done some great work on that. And she was on my podcast talking about that.
Yeah, I read a New Yorker article about her that was really fascinating. Yeah.
Oh, cool. So the idea that I have always resonated with, and I was wondering if you could tell me what the latest thinking about it is the set point theory of happiness. Mm-hmm. It does seem like we adapt quickly to the extreme highs and extreme lows in our life. And we tend to return to a sort of baseline level of happiness that is maybe set by the genes in terms of reaction range. And I was wondering where your thoughts are on our latest thinking about that.
Sure. So again, I think I want to offer kind of a more nuanced perspective on that than I think the average person might have. So the set point theory is sort of the idea that we all have kind of like a set point or like a baseline happiness, maybe in partly, you know, influenced by our genes and our environment. And then when things happen to us, like let's say we get like a raise at work, or we have a baby, or we have some kind of downturn, we lose our jobs, then our happiness kind of goes up and down, but then eventually it sort of goes back to the set point. And that process of sort of going back to our baseline, kind of what comes up must come down, or what comes down must come up, is called hedonic adaptation. Mm. Now, hedonic adaptation is a pretty powerful phenomenon, right? Human beings are really good at getting accustomed to changes in their lives. You can argue that evolutionarily adaptive, that like, we need to, you know, be really attuned to changes in our environments, right? We have to be attuned to sort of threats or to opportunities. But then when things are kind of the same, like we get a raise at work or we buy a new house, and first we're really excited about it, but then it's sort of the same, right? Like our house is kind of the same every day. Our new car, you know, is the same every day. We sort of adapt now. But research shows that we adapt much more quickly and much more completely to positive things than to negative things, right? So positive things, like I just mentioned, like we buy a new motorcycle, we buy a new bag, we even a relationship, right? We kind of adapt to. Like research shows that people tend to adapt to marriage, you know, on average after 2 years, people kind of go back to to their previous baseline. Now, of course, there's lots of individual differences there that are kind of hidden by the average. But with negative things, like when we lose our jobs, we get divorced, we have a disability, people tend to not adapt completely to a lot of those things. They still adapt, right? So they got to go down and they kind of start coming back up, but they don't adapt completely. So so our kind of quote set points, I don't really believe in set points, but those baselines could actually change. So we could sort of permanently, you know, become like a little bit less happy, say after experiencing a disability or after unemployment, which almost surprisingly to me, unemployment, on average, people don't adapt to completely.
Super interesting. I think about it obviously in terms of personality psychology. And one dimension I know you've been studying recently because you've really got an interest in connection as kind of this as the overriding central theme that runs through a lot, not overriding, but just a central theme that runs through a lot of different areas of positive psychology. I'd like to double click on this introversion, extroversion dimension for a second, because, you know, we might have a set point in the sense of like, I don't like the idea of set point, but like a baseline mm-hmm. On average temperament that exists. Mm-hmm. That certainly exists. Some Absolutely. People are grumpy. Some people are grumpy people. Some people are like, hey, how are you doing? And, you know, those people are annoying. But but anyway, that's my own judgment. We are, but we're not. Yeah. Hopefully, we're not annoyingly happy, yeah. right? There's a difference. There's a difference. That's a new construct. Annoyingly happy. there's also. I'm sorry. I'm like laughing right now.
Maybe annoying happiness. Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. like there's a scale. We should create that scale. Mm-hmm. You know, but anyway, what's so interesting to me is that you may be temperamentally an introvert, but your research shows that you can experimentally get people, regardless of whether they're temperamentally an introvert or extrovert, into certain situations, and it has effects that average over what your temperament is. Like that, you can override your temperament mm-hmm. in terms of the benefits of connection right. and sociality. So I'd love to hear about your research about that because it's so fascinating. So fascinating.
Exactly. So first of all, just a tiny bit of background. For years I've been doing these interventions where we try to make people happier by experimentally kind of prompting them to engage in certain kinds of strategies or new habits, like try to be more grateful in your daily life, you know, do acts of kindness, engage socially more with others. And it hit me a few years ago that almost all the interventions that we've ever done that have worked to make people happier work by making them feel more connected or interacting more with other people. So when you write a gratitude letter to your mom, it makes you feel more connected to your mom, right? When you do acts of kindness, it makes you feel more connected to the world in general or to the people that you're helping. And so, you know, but one of my favorite studies, so I think connection is really the key to happiness. So it sounds like such a cliche, right? But it took me like 20 years to get to the point where I'm like realizing right. connection is the key to happiness. So one of my favorite studies I did with my former student, Seth Margolis, where we asked people for 1 week to act more extroverted and then the sort of try to be more extroverted than you usually are. And then the second week, try to be more introverted than you usually are. We didn't actually use those terms because they have sort of connotations, or vice versa. And people got a lot happier during the week that they acted extroverted. They got less happier when they acted introverted. And it didn't matter whether they were originally kind of high or low on extroversion or introversion, which really surprised us. Like, we thought, you know, Susan Cain has this lovely work, this lovely book called Quiet. I'm sure your listeners know about it. And then she argues that it's exhausting for an introvert to act extroverted. Now, in our study, we didn't make them act extroverted all the time. They could sort of choose when. And so maybe in May, in a week was not that long. Now, there's another study that did something very similar coming out of Melbourne. They did find that introverts didn't benefit. They still benefited from the intervention to act more social. They didn't benefit as much. And also they showed bigger decreases in feelings of authenticity, which does make sense, right? They felt kind of less authentic. So there's some work now, very, very new, trying to figure out like what happens when you act kind of counter dispositionally, right? Like you act kind of against your personality. You might feel less authentic. I would argue you feel less authentic at first, but then over time it becomes a little bit more natural. Just like anything, when you try on a new identity or role, you know, you first, like when I became a professor, right? I felt really inauthentic. I felt like an imposter. But then over time, I just kind of got used to it.
Yes. Jesse Sun is doing wonderful research along those lines.
Well, she did the Melbourne study.
I know, homegirl. I know. That's why I want to give her credit. Yeah. I want to give her credit. Yeah. And I wrote about that article, about her research in Scientific American, if people want to read that article. So there's some nuances here. And I do think it's also interesting there was a study that came out showing that if you give extroverts too much socializing, they get tired too. They're not superhuman. They're not like, like both introverts and extroverts get exhausted with too much socializing, but their thresholds differ.
Exactly. Exactly. I want to make another point is that we have another paper that was looking at sort of why is it lots of research shows that extroverts are happier than introverts, which, by the way, that doesn't make me happy to know that finding, because I do agree with Susan Cain that like there's a lot of benefits to being introverted in our society and others. But they are happier. But it turns out that it's really like the energy component of extroversion. Extroversion has three components: assertiveness, sociability, which is what most people think extroversion is, but also energy level. They're sort of more energized.
Enthusiastic.
And so it's really the energy component that's related to happiness of extroversion.
Yeah. In the Big Ten model, Colin DeYoung calls that enthusiasm. They label it enthusiasm.
High arousal emotion.
High positive emotion, really. But there is research showing that that there's a modifier there, that happy introverts exist, and that happy introverts, the moderating factor is the extent to which they have self-acceptance.
Mm.
So I've always found that research. I've wrote about that as well. So funny we're talking about. I just tweeted this out. I retweeted someone who quoted me saying the biggest key to being a happy introvert is simply self-acceptance.
So is that like self-compassion or
just the extent to which you don't feel shame for being introvert, mm-hmm. the extent mm-hmm. to which you own it as part of your identity, you know, because there are those who read, you know, the Susan Cain's book, and then they make that introversion is like a really positive part of their identity, you know.
Right. And there are cultural differences, of course, because in other cultures, it's much more desirable to be introverted. Mm-hmm.
But this research you've conducted on this is so interesting, and it does show the power of social connections. Now, social connection is not necessarily the same thing as what energizes extroverts, which is social novelty. So social connection part can come within the agreeableness domain, perhaps. These things can be fractionated.
That is true. Although, you know, there's ours and other studies have, we just simply sometimes ask people to just interact more socially. So it doesn't have to be in a particular way. And it's interesting, just engaging more socially makes people happier. There's some lovely work by Nick Epley and his colleagues that shows that just, you know, if you ask people to like talk to a stranger on the bus or on the train, Liz Dunn has done this like at a coffee shop, people feel better. They think that it won't make them happy, but it actually does. So it's actually kind of amazing the power of social interactions. You know, we are, of course, social animals. And so, you know, research, you know, theory suggests that, you know, this is how like human, I'm totally blanking. Homo sapiens. Homo sapiens.
What are we called?
Survived like relative to other, like Homo habilis, you know, what happened to them? Because we're social, right? We're social creatures. So it's not surprising that being social would be associated with happiness and flourishing.
It makes sense. It makes sense. The trauma, loss, and uncertainty of our world have led many of us to ask life's biggest questions, such as who are we? What is our highest purpose? And how do we not only live through, but thrive in the wake of tragedy, division, and challenges to our fundamental way of living? To help us all address these questions, process what this unique time in human history has meant for us personally and collectively, and emerge whole, I've collaborated with my colleague and dear friend, Dr. Jordan Feingold, MD, to bring you our forthcoming book. It's called Choose Growth, a workbook for transcending trauma, fear, and self-doubt. It's a workbook designed to guide you on a journey of committing to growth and the pursuit of self-actualization every day. It's chock full of research from humanistic psychology, positive psychology, developmental psychology, personality psychology, cognitive science, and neuropsychology. So lots of themes that you hear about on this podcast. And it's aimed to help us all integrate the many facets of ourselves and co-create our new normal with a renewed sense of strength, vitality, and hope. Whether you're healing from loss, adapting to the new normal, or simply looking ahead to life's next chapter, Choose Growth will help steer you there to deeper connection to your values, your life vision, and ultimately your most authentic self. Choose Growth will officially hit the shelves September 13th, and you can order your copy or the audiobook in the US now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and all major retailers. If you're in the UK and Commonwealth, you can order now at bookshop.org.uk. We truly hope this book helps you grow and thrive and become your best self. Okay, now back to the show.
What happens if you force psychopaths to be more social? Do they become less psychopathic?
I don't think so. They probably would just use it to their... They do.
Oh,
they
yeah.
use it to their evil ends, right?
That's true. They're very manipulative. Yeah, that's a good point. I want to do that study from afar. Another fascinating area of research that you've been looking at lately is how MDMA can boost connection. Well, also can be a window into understanding what underlies feeling understood and connected. So can you tell me a little bit about some of your work on this and what you call, quote, here we go, psychedelic social psychology, end quote. Love that. Did you coin that?
I kind of want to inspire someone to start a new field called psychedelic social psychology.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe someone could, listeners can read. So I'm really excited about this work. So MDMA, the molecular name for it is 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine. It's otherwise called Molly or ecstasy. And it's a compound that has been shown both in sort of clinical trials and experimental research and also anecdotally to sort of foster feelings of closeness, warmth, trust, connection, empathy. People, while they're on the drug, they feel grateful, they feel compassionate, they want to help others, really, really, really connected. And so I thought, like, what a great drug to study as a window into studying social connection. And so when you're on the acute effects of MDMA is that people feel really like connected, really understood, valued, and cared for, which is, by the way, this is called partner responsiveness theory, Perry Reese, one of my favorite theories in psychology. And so studying this drug, we could use it as a research tool, as like a window to try and understand, like, what are the psychological ingredients and what are the neurobiological roots of feeling really connected. And so that research is ongoing and some has already been done, but also we can use it in an applied way to try to improve people's lives, right? So we have a loneliness epidemic. I think the UK even appointed a minister of loneliness. And so what if we give MDMA to lonely people, maybe just once, maybe with a booster? I'm not saying that you need to take it repeatedly to have the effects, because people say that they're really transformed when they take it because they feel so close. Your walls kind of come down. You're really able to sort of engage with people in a deep way. It's used for couples counseling, I think, for not surprisingly, because, you know, imagine a couple that's trying to like talk about conflict or something that's painful. People on MDMA don't feel defensive. You know, they don't feel the same kind of anxiety or fear. So it's really like kind of a beautiful molecule to study if you're interested in social connection, which of course is like a really important topic to study. Social connection is a basic human need. It's really a public health concern. It's associated with health and mental health and physical health and longevity. So yeah, I'm really excited about this research, and there's like a lot to be done. Of course, psychedelic science and psychedelic medicine is really taking off recently. So there's so much more to be done in this area.
Now, is this purely a theoretical interest?
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is. If you say so, yes.
Okay, if I say so. In the abstract, it says, finally, I discuss further questions whether using MDMA for enhancing connection can backfire. And so I thought that's interesting part of this paper as well. You know, how can that backfire? You know, I think that's important too.
Whenever you're talking about a drug, it's a Schedule I substance. And by the way, there's lots of things that are Schedule I that have been shown to have, say, much less harm than things like alcohol or nicotine that are not Schedule I, Schedule I means it's illegal, but it is being used in research, and there's some really amazing research coming out right now. So in terms of backfiring, we always have to be cognizant. So for example, if MDMA makes you feel really, really close to others, theoretically, you could, become really close to like a really bad person, right? Or an abuser, or like a Nazi or something, you know. That hasn't actually happened. I'm not aware of that. It could lead to like infidelity, right? It could lead you maybe to feel like you have to be on the drug to feel close, right? Now, again, I haven't seen that evidence in research, but I think we really need to look at that. I'm actually really interested in backfiring effects. Like the pursuit of happiness can also have backfiring effects.
I know.
Yeah. So yeah, if I might say a little bit about that, I have a chapter with a student about how the pursuit of happiness itself can backfire, where you could, for example, try to be grateful, try to do acts of kindness for others. And maybe your acts of kindness kind of doesn't make people feel good, right? And so you feel kind of less competent, or you might feel taken advantage of, or you might feel like it's a burden. Gratitude can make people feel kind of embarrassed or ashamed for needing the help in the first place, or not expressing gratitude earlier, or like a burden on other people when they realize how much, you know, others have done for them. Or sometimes it's awkward to share gratitude. So even these really positive habits and activities could sometimes have negative effects. So I think we have to be always sort of cognizant of those, or aware of those possibilities.
Yes, it's such an important topic that I want to double click on it. You and Megan M. Fritz coined this term, the happiness boomerang effect, mm-hmm. Which is exactly what you're describing, mm-hmm. when positive activities backfire. Not just positive activities, but can it backfire if happiness is your main goal in life? Like if you try to chase happiness every day of your life, can't that backfire as well?
Absolutely. And actually, that's a really great question, because I think a lot of people are doing that. You know, they're like, I want to be happy. And there's some really nice work by Iris Mauss and June Gruber and others that show that like overvaluing happiness, basically like really being preoccupied or kind of obsessed with like the pursuit of happiness, can actually undermine it, right? So the idea is that like when you're constantly tracking your happiness, when you're asking yourself, am I happy yet? Am I happy yet? Right? That might actually make you feel disappointed. You know, the idea, this is kind of, again, like kind of hokey, but the idea is that you want to sort of enjoy the journey to get there as opposed to just sort of focused on the goal, you know, because then you'll probably be disappointed. So I usually advise not to sort of focus too much on happiness, but focus on like the strategy. So for example, try to be more kind to others, try to interact more, act more extroverted, be more social, be more kind, but not necessarily say, I'm doing this to make myself happier. And is it working? Is it working? Because you might be disappointed.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think happiness is an epiphenomenon of other things that you focus on in your life, like meaning and purpose, for sure. I love this article you wrote, you know, with Dr. Fritz, right? Yeah, really love this article. And you make a really interesting point in there that when someone else is the recipient of kindness, you know, like there could be this utopian kind of idea in positive psychology. It's like, oh, well, of course, you know, that's going to give us well-being benefits. But look, we're human too. Mm-hmm. I mean, can't like jealousy come in? Can't like, you know, like normal other human drives that positive psychologists sometimes don't, they're like, don't even talk about that. Don't talk about that.
You know, I'm not, and by the way, I don't like the word positive psychology because it's not, it's not always positive. I just kind of go where the data lead. And so sometimes we find that, for example, we find that sometimes gratitude makes people feel a little worse. It makes them feel indebted, for example, right? When you're grateful to others, it makes you feel humble, which is usually a good thing. So, you know, you mentioned jealousy. We did a study because we're interested in like social media. What if you express gratitude on social media? Maybe that might make other people feel kind of bad, you know, like, you know, or like when you call out people, say at work, like, oh, thank you so much to Scott. He's doing such an amazing job. And then maybe your colleagues don't, you know, don't feel so good about that. We're interested in sort of pursuit of happiness kind of like online too, because of course it's such a big part of our lives now. Anyway, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah. It's just, it's so important. I love it. You're doing this and it's just, you're so productive. It's incredible. It's incredible. I mean,
you know, it's all my students and collaborators. I have the best students and collaborators, and they are,
that helps.
Love them so much. Yes.
That helps. But you know, even with all that wonderful modesty, even aside, there are solo authored publications I'm looking at right now. So you know, you can't hide from your amazingness for too long, because your soul amazingness, you can't hide from it for too long. Because even like this paper toward a new science of psychedelic sociology, it's a solo authored paper, and it's just really brilliant, really brilliant, truly brilliant how you integrate and bring together so many different threads within social psychology. You know, you have this, you have a chart of the different areas which it can be impacted. And I love how you mentioned creativity, by the way, because that's my area of study.
Wait, sorry, is that on the chart? Creativity?
Mm-hmm. You put creativity. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I have to say that paper, because I was so interested in this brand new, when I started working on it, it was about 3 years ago. Even then, you know, psychedelic medicine hadn't really been taking off as much. But I actually ended up sending it to like 25 colleagues, because I thought maybe a few of them would give me feedback, and like 24 of them, and I'm not going to call out the one person who didn't give me feedback, but 24 of them gave me extensive, detailed feedback. It was actually beautiful. And then I really worked hard to try to incorporate, you know, other people's ideas into that. So it took a village to write that paper.
I appreciate that. I do appreciate that. Well, you have a lot of projects going on in your lab right now, right? A lot of things happening. And I just wanted to go through and discuss some of them. One is what makes for good listening. And I know it's in the very early stages of research, but it's a very important topic, one near and dear to my heart. And the principles of Carl Rogers, unconditional positive regard, active listening, a lot of that is stuff that really inspired me in his writings. And I was wondering what modern day science, what you're finding so far.
So this is a really brand new project. We're also looking at conversations, right? Like what makes for great conversations? Because if the key to happiness is connection, and how do we connect? By talking to each other, basically. Mostly it involves talking. I mean, sometimes there's no talking, but there's, mostly. So I'm working with this really amazing researcher from Israel, whose name is Guy Itzchakov. And I was actually just messaging with him just now. And he's an expert on listening. So he's teaching us a lot about listening. And he studies what's called high quality listening, you know, and I have lots of ideas that, you know, I want to test, that we want to test, but sort of this idea that some of it, of course, is sort of maybe might sound obvious, like the kind of nonverbal, you know, gestures and expressions, eye contact, that you need to show that you really are truly listening. The kinds of questions that you're asking, my own pet peeve. I mean, you're a podcast host, so you're used to asking people questions. A lot of people don't ask questions, or they don't ask detailed questions that show that you're really listening, that you're really getting it, and that you want to know more. Right. And again, getting to partners, right, that you really are, that makes people feel understood. Right. So listening, the kind of listening that makes people feel really understood and valued and cared for, is the kind of listening that is improves relationships.
No, it's good to know that how the framework and the way that you and your colleagues are looking at that issue is going to be so important. I was thinking about Carl Rogers' notion of active listening, which is asking good questions. And that's what makes a good coach as well, is powerful, asking very powerful questions. And
yeah, so listening is so important, right? For like doctor-patient relationships, right? Therapist-client relationships, student-teacher relationships, romantic relationships, friendships, right? It's just so important. So I'm really excited about this sort of new line that we're sort of jumping into. Yeah.
I'm excited that you're looking into that. I saw a very interesting study the other day that tried to quantify what the optimal amount of talking is for a conversation for the other partner to perceive you as a good conversation partner. And I actually found, and the researchers actually found that people tend to underestimate how much talking they should actually do in a conversation, that people who talk more than they think they should are actually perceived as more confident, and actually the other person enjoys the conversation more. So that's kind of the interesting other side of the coin. You know, listening is important, but maybe too much. Again, it goes back to your backfire effect. Yeah. Backfire effect. Too much listening can be like, geez, do you have anything to say yourself?
Right. It has to be reciprocal. And there's this paradigm called fast friends, where it's used in research. It's also used sort of in applied context, where people kind of ask each other a series of increasingly personal questions. Because self-disclosure is really important too, right? Because if you're self-disclosing, you're really showing a part of yourself. You can't really feel understood if the other person doesn't really see what you truly are like inside. But it has to be, symmetric, right? Like if you're doing all the talking, or if you're one person doing all the listening, it feels uneven, right? And so it has to be symmetric. So this fast friends procedure, people take turns, right? So I might ask you, you know, a personal question, like when was the last time you cried in front of someone? And you might answer that question. And then I really listen, might follow up. And then it's my turn to answer the same question. Yes. And so that kind of reciprocation is really important to having like a deep connection.
100%. And also, trust is a really valuable one within a high quality connection. How much do you like or studied rely or draw on the work of Jane Dudden and high quality connections?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've read her work, right? So yeah, high quality HQCs, right? High quality connections.
Correct.
Right. And so she has a theory of sort of what makes up for high quality connections that are that is really relevant, right, to what we're studying. We're trying to sort of draw on everything there is on this in this research. So Bob Rosenthal, for example, is one of my colleagues at UC Riverside, where I am a professor. He, a long time ago, he did research on rapport. And so he had a theory of sort of, here are three aspects of rapport, including like synchrony. We haven't talked about synchrony, but that's
an important part of
connection. You know, we're kind of mirroring each other's gestures or movements. And so that's part of like having rapport. So that's also part of having, and I believe that's also part of Jane Dutton's work. And then Barb Fredrickson has work on what she calls positivity resonance, which is also sort of a theory about sort of sharing kind of positive emotion, positivity. Although we argue that if you could have sort of this resonance or feeling in sync even when it's not positive, right? Imagine shared grief, you know, or like shared anger at injustice, right? So you could have sort of negative, I don't know what to call it exactly, negative resonance. But anyway, so like really, I think it's really important to sort of stand on the shoulders of giants and see like what they have written and then kind of try to extend beyond what they have done. And again, my MO is to do experimental research. So we try to sort of test things that maybe have been shown like naturalistically happen in real life. And then we try to bring them in and sort of manipulate them to see if like, if you get people to sort of listen in this way, or if you get people to, interact in this way, will they become happier?
I love it. Also relates to Sarah Aljo's work, Positive Interpersonal Processes.
Right. Bind, what is it? Bind, find, and remind, or is it find, bind, and remind theory? So absolutely. So and she talks, for example, what's really relevant to us is the role of gratitude in relationships. And then basically she posits that the main function of gratitude is actually to kind of maintain and like strengthen social relationships. Absolutely. Really, really relevant work.
Love it. I'm also super interested in your work on interpersonal chemistry and how to create it. Because don't you talk to people sometimes and you feel a severe lack of interpersonal chemistry off the bat? And you kind of like, you know, you check your watch, you like look for the exit. What's going on there?
Yeah. So I have quite a bit to say about chemistry. We have, so Harry Reese, who's the sort of the who developed partner responsiveness theory, right, which is the importance of feeling understood and cared for and valued. So he and I and my student Annie Regan wrote a paper that kind of presented a theory of chemistry, because I believe no one had actually like kind of just visually kind of described what chemistry is. And so basically we propose that there's kind of two aspects of chemistry. What chemistry kind of looks like, you know, when you see it, like when you see chemistry, sometimes you see two people talking, and that's basically a series of what we call responsive interactions, where I sort of say something and you respond in a way, you listen in a way that make me really feel understood and cared for and appreciated. And then like, and then I do the same to you. So we have this sort of this interaction that keeps going. But then what does chemistry actually feel like? So, and I can kind of throw this out to your listeners, like when you've experienced chemistry with a person or with a group for that matter, or like a sports team, what does it feel like? Well, there's sort of three components. One is it feels good. You know, it feels positive. There's sort of liking, attraction, warmth. Another is you feel a sense of like shared identity, like or similarity, right? You're like on the same team or you're a couple. And then the third is you're typically pursuing goals. You know, so like if you and I have chemistry right now talking, we have kind of a shared goal in mind, which is this conversation or this podcast. You have sort of these shared, mutually, you know, interdependent goals. But like we really, Harry and Annie and I really believe that chemistry is something that can be built. You know, it's not like, you either have it or you don't, just like happiness. It's not easy, right? So my example is like, I have a lot of kids, I have four kids. And so I've been to a lot of like kid birthday parties. And I don't love going to kid birthday parties because you're just kind of stuck talking to people that you don't really know, you know, these other parents. And so like, let's say you're sort of talking to this other parent and they're not like that interesting to talk to. How do you draw them out, right? How do you build chemistry with them? Well, self-disclosure is important. So how do you get to kind of get them to disclose? So then you disclose and maybe you start asking them questions. You know, I remember talking to someone who I wasn't that interested in. So I was like, but I said, well, have you traveled? What's your favorite place that we traveled to? And he said, Greece. And actually I've never been to Greece. So I was like, well, tell me about that. What is Greece really like? You know? And so we ended up having a really nice conversation that had a little chemistry with it in it. You know, we kind of felt like, felt a little bit in sync. By the way, feeling in sync is probably the most, the key to chemistry.
Synchrony. In terms of our style. Yes. Yeah. But this sounds like these other things are precursors to synchrony. It seems like synchrony is more an outcome.
Or like a, it's a symptom.
Emergence.
Emergence. Yeah. These are all emergent phenomena. So I think it's debatable, right? Like sort of where in the time course things can happen. We kind of debated that a lot. So we could talk about that, sort of the nuances there.
You know, I love nuance. I mean, this is such a groundbreaking paper, because you distinguish between what chemistry looks like versus what it feels like. Mm-hmm. Now, these two things can come apart, right? Like, you know, you can have all the people in the media be like, Mary Sue and John, the two celebrities, you know, like, look at their amazing chemistry they have, and they'll be together forever, and then they get divorced the following week. So sometimes these things can come apart, right? Our perceptions can be different from how people actually experience it.
And no, it's true. That's true. We could certainly be wrong. But again, when we say what chemistry looks like, that's what I'm talking about, that those interactions, right? So you really need to see Mary and John in conversation and really kind of be a fly on the wall. So not just kind of them like taking photos together, but like really see, like, when they're having that conversation, are they kind of like throwing the ball back and forth in a way that makes them feel like they're feeling understood and appreciated. They really are, in sync with each other. So, but I agree. Sometimes we could just be wrong.
We can be. We can be. Okay. Can we be wrong too? Like in terms of our own perception, like it's like, what if I'm like, oh, wow. You know, Sonia, I think we're having such amazing chemistry right now. And you're like, Scott, nah.
It's actually a question that we even maybe have it somewhere in the paper. We considered, can chemistry be one-sided, right? Like you feel.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I asked.
And can I? Exactly. I know. That's why I brought it up. So, but we don't really know. Like, I think it's debatable. Like, is it really chemistry when only one person feels it? But I think we kind of settled on, like, maybe yes. Like, if you really feel you have all the sort of symptoms of chemistry, you're feeling the chemistry, you know, and I'm not feeling it, or vice versa.
You're not feeling it?
I'm feeling. I was just joking. I'm feeling amazing chemistry right now. Actually, I think if I might compliment you, Scott, I think your superpower is that you make people feel like at ease. You're very easy to talk to. And actually, that's one like channel into chemistry, right? You know, people who are kind of awkward and they don't say much and they sort of pause and they kind of look at you. You know, it's harder to develop chemistry with them. And you have an ease.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Well, people should know, you know, that we were friends in real life.
We're friends in real life. Yeah, we are friends in real life.
People might not know that. So this is not as awkward as it sounded.
Full disclosure, we are friends in real life, although new friends.
Okay. So what is this idea of, that you can count too many blessings? I find that research fascinating. I saw you actually at a NIPA conference talk about that research like 6 years ago. And it fascinated me ever since.
And we still don't have all the data.
Okay, fair enough.
Can you count too many blessings? Okay, so there's a phenomenon in social psychology called the effort as information heuristic. Okay, effort as information heuristic. And the classic study was done by Norbert Schwartz at USC. And they asked people, I think, I don't remember the numbers, but something like list like five assertive behaviors that you have done recently, like assertive behaviors, or list like 15 assertive behaviors. So the more behaviors people are forced to list, the less assertive they think they are, because it's harder for them to think of 15 assertive behaviors. Or you ask college students at the end of a class, list like 12 things you liked about your professor, or list three things you liked about the professor. The people who list or ask to list 12 things actually don't like the professor as much overall, because it's hard for them to think of 12 things. So could that be true for counting blessings, right? If I ask you to think of like 20 things that are good in your life right now, and maybe you have some trouble coming up with 20 things, you might conclude that your life is not as fortunate as you thought it was. And also it could just be kind of a burden. So we did a study where we asked people to count two blessings, four blessings, or eight, or 16, or 32 blessings, and sort of measured their affect. And we found that what do you think was the Goldilocks kind of number of blessings? 2, 4, 8, 16, or 32?
I was going to say eight.
You know, I thought it'd be four, but eight is actually the right answer.
It intuitively felt right to me.
But we are trying to replicate that study. We haven't been able to replicate it. So, you know, just full disclosure, we'll see what happens, if that's a real effect or not.
It's such a valuable nuance within the field that says, like, count your blessings. You know, it's like.
Yeah. Another nuance in the field. Again, my student Annie did a study for her like master's thesis where she compared what's sort of more happiness promoting for gratitude, writing a gratitude letter or like gratitude list, right? Counting your blessings. And it turns out that letters or kind of essays are more happiness inducing than lists. And I think it's not that surprising when you're writing like a whole essay. It's more meaningful. It's more rich, right? You could talk about like, oh, my mom has done all these things for me. If it's just a list, it's sort of not as, it's a little bit more trivial.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I know a topic you could go on all day about is the use of smartphones and social media. And how it's making us maybe unhappy in some ways. Can you talk about the research you found on the association between these things?
Yeah, I'm going to try to be sort of brief. So another former student, Lisa Walsh, this is sort of her wheelhouse. And she did a dissertation. So there's lots of research on this. You know, Jean Twenge published a lot of research showing that, you know, smartphone use is, or technology, I would say social, digital media use is associated with lower well-being, more suicidality, you know, more depression, especially in girls, and really maybe only in girls. Boys tend to play video games that are more social. Anything that's sort of more social tends to be happiness inducing, or at least not reducing. So especially in girls, and especially in teen and tween girls, that's where you kind of see the negative correlations. Other researchers show or try to argue that the correlations are really tiny. So there's sort of this debate about like, are they really tiny? I mean, they are tiny, but like, does that matter? And Jean Twenge, full disclosure, is also a friend of mine and a collaborator. Mm-hmm. She argues, even though these are small correlations, they really do matter, especially when you break them down by gender and age. So there's a debate, you know. So again, my take on the debate is that smartphone use, but particular social media use, does seem to be negatively associated with well-being, but this is mostly true for girls and for young girls. Okay, so that's sort of my take on the literature. Now, those are all correlations, right? So it could be that, you know, if you're depressed to begin with, you're going to use social media more. Now, mixed evidence on that. So really, we need to do experimental research. So there's some studies on this. So Lisa did for her dissertation a big experiment where she asked people to for a week or about 8 days to give up their smartphone use as much as possible, or their social media use. So she actually had, it's actually kind of brilliant dissertation. She had four groups. Either you are asked to, as much as possible, get off all digital media, all smartphone use. Now, of course, like if you have to absolutely do something for work, or, you know, or check Facebook because there's an event happening and you want to know where it is, that's okay. So one condition, they're giving up as much as possible their digital media use. Another condition, they're just only giving up social media use. Another condition, they're sort of not doing anything, we're just tracking them. And then we wanted to have a control condition where people are kind of like giving up something that maybe makes them feel a little bit good. And it was really hard to come up with that, right? Because we thought like maybe they should give up sugar, or but it doesn't work for everyone. So actually my teenage daughter had the idea as to use less water, right? So we live in California, water is really, well, in lots of places, it's very valuable. So, you know, whatever, you not drink less water, use less water. So what we found was that, we didn't have big effects. We did find just with the reducing social media, some positive effects of reducing social media. We did actually find a really interesting correlation. When you look at correlations between uses of these different technologies and well-being. And by the way, the uses were tracked by what's it called? A screen time app in iPhone. So this was like very hardcore, rigorous tracking. Because people don't know how much, like how many hours did you use your phone today, right? You don't know, right? And it turned out that some apps were associated with less happiness and some worth more or not associated. And the less was like Twitter, Facebook, more happiness, Snapchat. I mean, we don't know why. And I'm not like a promoter of that company, but that was kind of interesting finding.
What about TikTok?
I'll have to look that up. I think, in fact, I can look it up now. It's
so popular.
Yeah, I know. TikTok, maybe the most popular.
What about Instagram versus Twitter?
I think both of them were negatively associated with happiness.
Yeah, because I see that with Twitter. But I feel like Instagram's happy. I feel like people on Instagram are happier, like just in terms of the way they write and talk to each other. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't find that in terms of their own happiness, but maybe like positivity. If you code, is that what you're saying? Kind of, if you code positivity in people's posts.
I don't know what I'm saying. It just seems like Instagram. What I'm saying is, it seems like from my experience that people are happier on Instagram. People are grumpier on Twitter. There's lots more heart emoticons on Instagram.
Yeah. Okay, so the positive relations with happiness are gaming apps, right? So because again, they're more social. News Real app, actually. Yeah. Camera app is positive associated with happiness. That makes sense because you're kind of taking photos, and Snapchat is positive associated with happiness. Negative associations that are actually significant are, let's see, dating apps. Tinder, Twitter, Safari, Mail, Facebook, Blackboard. That's funny. WeChat. Blackboard is the one that, you know, college students use. So I guess they're.
yeah, that makes sense. But not Instagram.
Let's see where Instagram is. I think Instagram is just not significantly related to. Huh. Oh, yeah, here it is. Instagram, negative, but not. It's basically zero. And TikTok is also the same as Instagram. It's basically zero correlation with happiness.
So interesting. And as you said, it really probably matters when you break it down to the demographics even more, by age and gender and other demographics.
Right. Our participants in this study were all what are called iGen or Gen Z, because that's the population we're kind of more worried about. But yeah, we'd love to do something with like across, you know, lots of age groups.
Yeah, it'd be really important research. Really important. The last question I wanted to ask you is this connection between mind and body. I know you've done some physiological and hormone markers and various things. How can acts of kindness boost our immune profile? And then how have you investigated that?
Yeah, I'm super excited about this work. So this is work with my students and former students. Thank you. And actually a former grad school buddy and friend named Steve Cole. Who is a social psychologist who retrained as an immunologist. He's at UCLA. And so he does what are called genomic analyses, looking at RNA gene expression. So we've now have two different studies because we replicated the first, where we ask people, again, it's an experiment. We ask people to do acts of kindness for others. So we have one group do acts of kindness for others, another group do acts of kindness for yourself, which I think is a great comparison condition because it makes you feel good in the moment to kind of treat yourself to like a massage or a candy bar or something, or nap. And then we also have sort of a group that sort of tracks their activities. So they're kind of trying to organize their time, but it's kind of fairly neutral. And what we find is that only the group that does acts of kindness for others is over a period of 4 weeks. We collect their blood spots, their blood before and after the intervention. Only that group shows changes in their RNA gene expression that are associated with a healthier immune profile. So they show less pro-inflammatory gene expression. So think inflammation, more inflammation is bad. So we have less pro-inflammatory gene expression. We have some indication in the second study of what we're not sure about, that of more antiviral gene expression. So really, really cool. Wow. So again, doing acts of kindness for others leads people to show in their blood sort of downregulation of pro-inflammatory genes. So we're super excited about that.
I am super duper excited about that. we need to get the word out there, you know, in this environment of lots of divisiveness and that kindness matters.
So helping others makes you happy, but it maybe might even prevent you from catching viruses or getting sick. But we don't know that because this is just a marker, right? So we actually are not looking at kind of quote real health.
Thank you for that nerdy caveat. Sonia, it is amazing to have you finally on the Psychology Podcast.
Haven't you asked me to be on it before?
I know. I have, but you know I have. I have. You're a busy human. You're a busy human. But honored to call you a friend. And Yeah, I'm so enamored by your career, and I mean, you are legitimately a legend in the field of psychology. You're a legend.
Thank you, Scott. No, I love doing this work, and again, my students and clients, the best part of it, because of, you know, because of connection, right? The best part of it is working with other humans, right? With my students and collaborators, and doing this kind of thing, like talking to you, talking to other people to disseminate the science is really super fun.
Can't wait to get this out there. Thanks.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.